Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Hey, everybody. A great one today. Finally, Norm Ornstein's a scholar emeritus from the American Enterprise Institute. Norm has been the go-to on Congress for decades now. And has joined me before on this podcast when things are heating up on the Hill. And of course, the story this week continues to be the shit show in the House. Jim Jordan is now chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. And we know we're in for 2 years of getting sicker and sicker of Jim Jordan. This past week, Jordan announced a special subcommittee to investigate the weaponization of the federal government against the right. We're going to get to see the deep state, finally. I've been waiting to see the deep state, haven't you? And learn how exactly the deep state works. Because when I was in the Senate, I was on the Judiciary Committee and dealt, you know, with our intelligence agencies. Mainly when I was there, they were focused on trying to prevent a terrorist attack from Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And in doing so, swept up a lot of metadata on the phone calls of a lot of Americans, which, as you'll recall, was a big deal when Snowden revealed that they had been doing that. So I got kind of deep into this and talked to my colleagues on the Intelligence Committee. And maybe I was just naive or stupid or blind, but the intelligence agencies were not spending a lot of time and resources focusing on the right. Of course, more recently, they started to, and for good reason, 3 years ago, this is obviously before January 6th, FBI Director Christopher Wray testified to the Judiciary Committee that the militant right was a much bigger and far more organized and far more dangerous threat than, say, Antifa, which Wray said was not organized. No surprise. And yet, obviously, the FBI wasn't focused enough on the far right because somehow they missed January 6th, which Jim Jordan might probably have been a part of. I think you'll remember that the January 6th committee subpoenaed Jordan to testify. We know that Jordan spoke with President Trump on January 6th a number of times. And the committee wanted to know more about that because you may remember that Jordan was a little unclear about that when he was asked by a reporter how many times he spoke with the president on January 6th. Let's play that.
On January 6th, did you speak with him before, during, or after the Capitol was attacked?
I'd have to go. I spoke with him that day after, I think after. I don't know if I spoke with him in the morning or not. I just don't know. I'd have to go back and. I don't know when those conversations happened. But what I know is I spoke with him all the time.
That is the best humana I've ever heard, and that's why Jordan was subpoenaed by the January 6th committee, along with a few other Republicans who seemed to be in on the plot to stop the steal, and of course. All of them ignored the subpoenas. So I'm wondering if Jordan expects the witnesses that he subpoenas to actually show up. That, you know, they're congressional subpoenas. Anyway, that's going to be an interesting wrinkle. Well, let's get a little bit more perspective on what we're going to be facing over the next couple of years. It's going to be a great one, as usual, because it's Norm Ornstein.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
How long have you been studying the Congress, Norm?
I've been immersed in it since 1969.
Okay.
That's a long time.
And you were at AEI, still are. Right? You're an emeritus there.
I'm an emeritus, yeah.
Okay, and AEI thought normally as a conservative think tank, you were kind of a middle-of-the-road moderate. You worked with both sides. You worked on McCain-Feingold, which was campaign finance reform. You had good relations with pretty much every side. It wasn't so extreme then, right?
Exactly so. And I worked, you know, I could come up with a list of 100 Republicans in the House and Senate that I worked with on different things. A lot of them were reform measures, you know, trying to reform the House and Senate. I worked with people like David Dreyer, who for a time was the Republican chair of the House Rules Committee.
Yep.
Alan Simpson in the Senate, with a lot of people, some of whom are there, a lot of whom are gone, but I couldn't think of a single one now I'd want to be in the same room with.
Yeah, well, that brings us to when new speaker was voted in a harrowing process, and a process which Kevin McCarthy determined to be the speaker, a group of 20 right-wing radicals making sure that if he got it, they had all the power. Is that a good summary?
That's a good summary. Look, let's start with a brutal reality for anybody trying to lead in an extremely closely divided House. So there's a majority of 5 for Republicans, which means any six members can screw things up completely for you, can block you from anything if you're not going to get any support from the other side. Well, Nancy Pelosi had a majority of 4 and managed artfully to pull all of her factions together, no embarrassment of a second, third, fourth, much less 15th ballot to get to be speaker. But what we also know is she didn't have to trade anything to achieve that goal. She didn't have to give crazy people in her own caucus powers that they didn't have, or create a rules committee, for example, where there was no control. And for Kevin McCarthy, he had to sell his soul and various parts of his body to a group of the most radical faction in the House just to be able to get control. And we're going to see the payoffs from that, which are going to be pretty tough for all of us a little bit further down the road. But he ceded all power.
I want to go into, in a minute, in a little while, the power that he has ceded and the position he's put himself in, which really gives this tremendous power to the most right-wing radical members of the Republican Party, the distinction I would say with Pelosi. Yeah, she had a margin of 4. There was no one in the Democratic House caucus that could be in any way compared to the Freedom Caucus in the Republican Party in terms of what tactics they're willing to use, and also in terms of the most left-wing Democrats in that caucus want to do stuff. They want government to accomplish things. So their radical vision was a Green New Deal.
Yeah.
What they wanted to do that was so radical is address climate change.
Well, climate change also provides safety net protection for Americans who need it. Crazy things like child care and a child tax credit, all of those elements. You're exactly right.
That is a difference that I don't think people, that distinction is not made enough. Because what's the most left-wing caucus among the Democrats?
It's, well, you know, they don't have any equivalent of the Freedom Caucus or even the Republican Study Committee. The closest that they have is the Progressive Caucus, which has been chaired by Pramila Jayapal, which has a significant number of members. A lot of them are anything but left-wing radicals. Most of them are not in that position. In fact, you know, the Republicans who criticized what they call the radical left don't refer to the Progressive Caucus. They refer to the Squad, which they just named as this group originally of four members.
And one of them is Ilhan Omar from Minneapolis. And they took her off what committee?
They took her off of the Foreign Affairs Committee, you know, just because basically they don't like her. And of course, their focus has been AOC, who is a major national figure.
But if you think of AOC, let's focus on AOC for a second.
Yeah.
She is a serious member. She's to the left of a lot of mainstream Democrats, but she represents a big part of the Democratic Party, first of all, but not a crazy part of the Democratic Party, just a part of the Democratic Party who wants to move to, a child tax credit.
She is well within the mainstream of longstanding American politics and discourse. Also, I have to say, she is one of the most impressive young members of the House that I have seen in all of my years around. If you watch her, have watched her doing her 5 minutes of interviews,
questioning,
she has been, I would say, the Al Franken of the House.
I was going to say that. But no, I remember the first few times I saw her in committee asking questions, I went, she is prepared. And her questions were always spot on. And so this is someone who does the work and is smart and who is really representing her constituency. But she's not someone trying to be destructive. That's the contrast I see with the Freedom Caucus, that they don't, I don't see them as like caring about healthcare policy or education policy or cybersecurity. What they seem to do is make compromise impossible. And this concerns me going forward. And ultimately, I think we need to talk about what's going to happen down the road on the debt ceiling. We don't have to get to that right now, but that is a very scary thing. We confronted that when I was in the Senate in 2011.
There is an enormous contrast here that you're getting at, that whether you like her policy positions or not, AOC is serious about policy and cares about solving problems. The people who have gotten so much attention in the news, the ones who brokered all of these concessions from McCarthy, the ones who are going to be chairing most of the key committees, are more nihilist than they are problem solvers. They don't care about their own institution. They don't care about the American system of governance. They are not there to do positive things. They're there to try and blow up as much as they can. And that's the most significant, in many ways, contrast between the two parties now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they do always want to cut taxes, right? And I'm trying to think of so where they could say, no, we believe in small government and we want to address the deficit and we want fossil fuels because we want to be energy independent. We want to be strong in that way. I mean, they'll say they're for stuff, right?
They have talking points They repeat their talking points, but it's mostly nonsense. All of this talk about smaller government and, of course, all of the hypocrisy, watching them on the floor where they were talking about how they were going to balance the budget. The first thing that they wanted to do was blow up the IRS, which the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan, fair-minded Congressional Budget Office, said would add $114 billion to the deficit. It just shows that this is all talking points and empty rhetoric.
Right now, the IRS doesn't have the personnel to go after wealthy people. And that's deliberate.
It's very deliberate. If you go back over the past 20 years, Republicans have used the appropriations and budget process to pare down the IRS and then to attack it in ways that have taken dedicated career people, including, you know, the most sophisticated CPAs there, and basically tried to drive them out of the agency. The idea is that these high-powered lawyers and accountants working for billionaires would then have an even bigger advantage. But it was also to try and take away the capacity of the IRS to actually get the money due under the existing tax laws. And they've had enormous success doing that. And one of the first casualties and an ongoing casualty has been the ability to do audits of the wealthiest among us and of corporations as well, which means they're getting away with tax cheating because they know there's no accountability for it. And now this 87,000 people who are going to be added to the IRS over 9 years, 50,000 to replace retiring accountants and other agents, the rest for people to answer the phones, to actually process returns so that working class and middle class people who are expecting to get refunds can actually get them on a timely basis. Often people who are going from paycheck to paycheck and really need that money and now have to face very long delays. So this is more an attempt to blow up government, not to say as a conservative would, a small government conservative would, you know, I want a smaller government, but I also want honesty and fairness. If we are going to create a tax code that has boundaries on it, people need to respect those boundaries. That's what law and order means. And we need to raise the revenue that we expect to raise to fund the government that we're going to have. And they're not after that at all. They just want to blow up government, period, and protect their billionaire friends.
My understanding is that people who get the earned income tax credit, they're audited at a higher rate than people who make lots and lots of money and shelter their money and hide it and use every, you know, have high paid accountants. That requires sophistication and time to audit those. And that's what we're talking about. That's where the money is. That's who we need to be looking at. We don't really need to be looking so much at people who make, what, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 a year getting the earned income tax credit.
That's exactly right. And what's important to note here is, and to emphasize here, is that we don't need to raise taxes if we are able to bring into the Treasury the money that tax cheats are taking away that has to be then paid for by working class taxpayers, including those who are getting an earned income tax credit. That's all that would be required to replenish the Treasury and bring us back to solvency. And of course, they're against that. They want to protect tax cheats.
They want to protect rich people. and they're the people that fund them, right?
Of course, this is partly a quid pro quo, but it's also an ideological extremist viewpoint. And here's where you get to, I think, the crux of it with so many of these people. They don't want a smaller government. They want no government. They want to blow up the federal government, believing in their delusional way that if there is no more government, then people will breathe freedom and everything will be all right. And of course, it's nonsense. But they also have to use these kinds of talking points in their rhetoric, because the government that they want to blow up is extraordinarily popular, including among Republicans out in the country. So they have to deal with this at a different level and, you know, trying to divert attention away from the reality of what they're trying to do, which we know now includes eviscerating Social Security and Medicare and trying yet again, as they've tried for decades, to block grant Medicaid and cut the funding by an enormous amount, which would cause havoc out in the country.
Let's talk about that, because the end game here, as I see it, is the debt ceiling. I remember in 2011, we went up to the last minute, right?
Yeah.
And we actually, you know, our bond ratings went down because we came close, and it was scary. Because if you go past the debt limit, then we're suddenly defaulting. And the dollar, which is the reserve currency of the world, becomes suspect. And this can cause a worldwide economic crisis and a recession, a worldwide recession. So, I mean, that is, there's a gun to the head of the other party. It feels like these guys, these new guys, are ready to pull the trigger.
Let me just go back with a little recap. So the Tea Party people come in 2010. And the first thing that they want to do, and let us say egged on and abetted by the so-called young guns, the self-proclaimed young guns, that was Eric Cantor and Kevin McCarthy in particular, decide that they're going to use the debt ceiling as a hostage to pound away at Obama and force him to make all kinds of concessions, which included slashing domestic spending and Social Security and Medicare.
And this is during the Great Recession. And our economy has yet to get back on its feet. The stimulus package in 2009 had been too small. I think everyone has agreed on that. And the last thing we needed were cuts in spending.
Yeah. So they push this right up near the edge of the abyss. And to his credit, John Boehner pulled them back. And Boehner understood the consequences of this for the country. And that was the beginning of the end of his speakership, of course. And let me say that after it was over, Jason Chaffetz, one of the Tea Party crazies then serving in the House, said, "We were serious. We would have gone right over the cliff." That was then. 2011, there was no Freedom Caucus then. The right-wing caucus was called the Republican Study Committee. It had a majority of the members of the Republican Party in the House. You had the Tea Party movement, but it wasn't a formal group. 2015, the Freedom Caucus is created because the right-wing caucus isn't right-wing enough. And now, I would say probably even if they are not formal members, a clear majority of House Republicans are Freedom Caucus types, and Kevin McCarthy doesn't have anywhere near the wherewithal, the spine.
Well, he's given up, I mean, in negotiating to get the speakership.
But there, you know, we're probably looking, it's not exactly clear when, because there are a number of emergency measures that can be used. Sometime late spring, early summer is when we bump up against the debt ceiling. And Steve Scalise, the majority leader, today refused to say that he would keep us from going into default. McCarthy would be powerless to stop it, even if he wanted to. So we're going to have to find other means to keep from default. And remember, default, losing the full faith and credit of the United States, the global currency, would lead to not just economic mayhem here, but around the globe. It would have enormous implications for the global economy.
They think about that because that's the gun they're holding to everybody else's head. But the problem is they're willing to pull the trigger.
Yeah, and they've got it fully loaded.
Now, let's talk about the concessions that McCarthy gave to the Freedom Caucus, including that it only takes one member to call a vote to vote for Speaker again. So he has no leverage, none.
No, no leverage at all. And I actually, it is the case that this was the policy before Nancy Pelosi changed it.
No one used it, though, did they?
Well, the Republicans in the House threatened it against Boehner in 2011. Actually, introduced a resolution that never came to a vote. But that was the signal that he knew that his time was limited. But now we're in a different place. We are in a place where, having already forced out basically a number of their leaders and speakers.
Talking Boehner and Ryan.
Yeah, and Ryan. That they are ready to act if anything bad happens.
They're willing to use it to get what they want. And knowing McCarthy, he'll have to fold.
What they know is, and this was the case with the 20 who opposed him in the first place, McCarthy is weak. McCarthy will be pushed and bullied into doing what they want. That's actually, in some ways, ironically, why 20 of them opposed him, because they see him as a feckless leader without any principles. It's all about grasping and holding on to power so they can get whatever they want from him.
And they said that in the in the debates on the floor. And then later, that Gates particularly, and then later voted for him to make him speaker. But it's sort of he's feckless. He'll say whatever he has to say. And at the end, that's why I voted for him, because, we have him by the balls.
Absolutely. And of course, we know what Gates said before, even after he embarrassed McCarthy yet again on that 14th vote. He said, "I've run out of things to ask for." Now, we still don't know everything that McCarthy has given, because there's that 3-page secret document, side document with concessions that he made. But we know some of them. We know that he gave in, for example, going back to the debt limit, by promising that he would not bring up under any circumstances a straightforward, clean debt limit increase, that it would have to have conditions attached to it. We know that he agreed to not just create this new committee to investigate the federal government that I refer to as the Obstruction of Justice Committee, but that he also agreed on who the members would be, who some of the members would be. It's going to include a bunch of the people who are under investigation for their role on January 6th to try and go after and block the investigations of the Justice Department into the criminal behavior on January 6th. And chillingly, he agreed to give this committee the same power that the Intelligence Committee has to get access to the most sensitive secrets involving sources and methods and other interactions with other intelligence agencies in our intelligence world.
What they're trying to do is counter the January 6th committee by throwing up a couple of transgressions during the investigation into the Russian interference on like FISA warrants. And, in the 2000s, and just throw up a lot of chum to feed to the MAGA crowd to neutralize all the January 6th committee findings.
And they're still trying to whitewash it. They're trying to suggest it was a bunch of tourists, and they are defending the January 6th violent insurrectionists who are either awaiting trial in a D.C. jail or who have been convicted, saying that they are operating under inhumane circumstances and that they are political prisoners. It's just almost beyond belief. And we know that it's the Scott Perrys and Jim Jordans and Andy Biggses and Paul Gosars of the world who are going to be running this.
Let me ask you about the Rules Committee in the House. and what their job is? Because my understanding is, I don't know if we know the exact number of these Freedom Caucus members who are going to be on the Rules Committee, and what the power of the Rules Committee is in the House.
So the two houses are different. The Rules Committee in the House is able to maintain almost ironclad control over what gets to the floor of the House and what, if any, amendments can be offered on all the bills. It is not free-flowing in debate the way the Senate is. It can be restricted much more. And the Rules Committee in the past has basically been, in our lifetimes or in our adult lifetimes, leadership committee. The members are picked by the leader, and the leader picks people who are going to be loyal to him. That's the normal pattern. And sometimes they will ease up and allow more amendments. Now, McCarthy has agreed to give, at least in theory, a lot more amendments to rank and file members. But what we know is that by putting at least three Freedom Caucus members on the Rules Committee, they're going to have the ability, most likely, to block things that the leader wants to do, unless he gives up even more concessions, to try and move to allow amendments that they like while keeping off amendments that they don't like to bills on the floor. And this, you could argue, is the most powerful committee in the House, because it can determine the flow of debate and what actually gets there. If you go back many decades, the segregationist, ultra-conservative chair for a long time under the Democrats was a man named Howard Smith of Virginia. He single-handedly blocked any civil rights legislation and much of the New Deal legislation from getting to the floor of the House for years and years, until finally then-Speaker Sam Rayburn was able to take that power away. But this is an extraordinarily powerful committee now that will effectively be run by the radicals. They've added back in a rule that requires a three-fifths vote to increase any taxes. They've called for more tax cuts, and they say they will bring a balanced budget to the floor.
Right. You know, they do that every time, but it is, of course, impossible.
Let's just, for a minute, give a little primer on the budget. 70% is in entitlements, as we call them. That's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, farm subsidies, food stamps, and the like. The rest, 30%, is basically divided almost half and half. Not quite. There's a little more in defense, between defense and the so-called discretionary domestic spending. That's energy and the environment and education and the CDC and most of the rest of healthcare. It's all of the other programs that are not a part of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They've already been cut dramatically from what they otherwise would be over many decades. If you're going to bring a balanced budget where you're continuing to cut taxes and you can't increase revenues, you would have to dramatically slash Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the domestic budget. And they're talking about very serious cuts in the defense budget, which they will try to target so that no aid goes to Ukraine. But it will also, if it happened, effectively undermine our national security interests. It would be the best news that China, which is still eyeing Taiwan in the same way that Russia has eyed and gone after Ukraine, the best news that they could have. It would make Putin giddy. And of course, it would wreak havoc on most Americans who rely on a lot of these programs.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Norm Ornstein.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
If you're constantly on the hunt for a good deal, then you need Rakuten. Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop because members get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, traveling, dining, and more. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while you're doing it? It's a no-brainer. Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million members who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Your cashback really adds up.
We're back with Norma Ornstein. What other areas are...
Let's turn to the brighter side.
Well, yeah, they're going to be trying to go after people in the federal government. They're going after the deep state, right? Like Anthony Fauci.
Fauci, who is now resigned, and of course, it tells you something about the lunacy of these people, that a man who devoted his entire career to protecting public health is now somebody they want to criminalize. And of course, they also want to undercut funding they already have for the Centers for Disease Control. Let's not let the radical Supreme Court off the hook, which basically has moved to undermine the CDC's authority to deal with a public health emergency by saying, unless it's specifically in the law, and that means it can let out viruses that are unknown or variants, makes it harder for them to implement policies to protect public health. We're talking about nihilists yet again. Now, beyond Fauci.
What is their case against Fauci? I mean, this is gain of function.
They're saying that he lied about the cause of the virus, that he lied about the implications of the virus, that he lied about the efficacy of masking and of the vaccines. It's all a bunch of made up stuff.
On the masking thing, at first we thought it was on the surface. We didn't know that it was airborne.
Yeah.
That lasted, I don't know, that was a month or so, right? That was very early on, and he said, no, you don't have to wear a mask, and then said, nope, you do have to wear a mask. That's what happens when you find out, when science figures out what's what. And
exactly.
That's nothing sinister. That's just what it is. But this gain of function, they're trying to basically blame the coronavirus on Anthony Fauci. They're trying to say that he gave technology, or that we helped give technology to the Chinese, that gain of function, I guess, is experimenting with viruses to see how to kill them when you change them. And they're saying that we gave them some of that technology in China, and that's how this got out of control. Is that their argument?
That's exactly their argument. And they see him as the poster child. And of course, a part of it was a feeling on their behalf that whenever Trump would hold his press conferences and, you know, get up and talk about COVID and then turn it over to Fauci, that Fauci would undercut him by relying on facts.
Right.
And the picture, as Trump talked about injecting bleach and some of these other nutcase remedies, the stricken look on Fauci's face.
Well, it was Burke's face.
Yeah, but also Fauci put his head in his hands.
Oh, okay. I remember hers famously. Of course, when Biden in the debate said you could inject bleach. Remember what Trump said? He said, I was being sarcastic, and you know it.
Yeah.
And you go back there. He was not being sarcastic. He was just...
Bring up the video.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it... There's a tremendous number of the lungs, so it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
Yeah, he was really being sarcastic.
Yeah.
And also, the Trump administration cut a lot of our scientists in China, right? The funding for them.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Cut the ability to do any oversight of whatever labs they had there.
Now, Norm, as I understand it, they want to cut the salaries of certain federal employees. That'll be ugly, wouldn't it?
You can't use legislation to attack individuals, but that's what they're going to try to do. However, more than likely what they're going to try and do with it is to cut the pay of broad swaths of people working in the federal government. They're going to try and go after the FBI by cutting pay for bureaus within the FBI. They're going to try and cut off some of the funding for the Department of Homeland Security so that they can make their case, their nonsensical case, that we have an open border. All of this is going to not just undermine the administration of government, but again, undermine our national security. We're dealing with a bunch of lunatics.
Okay, so they're barely in control of the House. We're kind of barely in control of the Senate, but we are. We added a seat.
Yep.
What's the tension going to be between what's coming out of the House and dealing with the Senate? Because I've seen this before. I mean,
yeah.
We did this in 11. We had a Republican House and we had a Democratic Senate. They just held a gun to our head. That's when you got this lot of budget cuts, what was called the sequester, right?
Yes.
And the sequester put in a certain amount of spending limit at a time when the Great Recession was still, we had not recovered from it. And so it was doing the opposite of helping the economy recover.
And, you know, again, let's get into a little bit of history. Why did we have the sequester? When we went through all of these ups and downs in 2009, 10, and 11, with all these efforts to try and balance the budget, even though it was not the right time to be doing it. And we had the creation of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, and we had the Rivlin Commission. None of them went anywhere. And the Simpson-Bowles Commission recommendations didn't go anywhere because it required a supermajority, and Paul Ryan refused to go along and got some of his colleagues to refuse to go along because they weren't going to go for any increase in taxes. So finally, as a last-ditch effort, they set up this—
Ryan would not allow increases in taxes, and Simpson-Bowles wanted to do it.
Yeah, they wanted to have a balance where you had revenues increased and changes in the path of growth of Social Security, Medicare, and some of the other programs. Some of the Democrats were willing to go along with that. Then they set up this gang of 12, and the way they set it up, and this was something that Obama and congressional leaders agreed to, they wanted to force them to come to an agreement by saying, if you can't reach an agreement, then we're going to have this draconian practice of across-the-board cuts, which, of course, means that you're cutting some of the most essential programs because it's mindless, believing that, of course, they won't allow that to happen because they're rational. And the Republicans in House and Senate, but especially actually the Republicans in the Senate at the direction of Mitch McConnell, refused to go along with any tax increases again. Pat Toomey was their leader in this group of 12. And so we ended up with these mindless sequesters, and that's takes us back to what you were talking about with the damage that was done by requiring these other concessions. So this goes back, the seeds of this.
What I'm saying there is that when they have a gun to your head, and the biggest gun will be the debt ceiling.
Yeah.
What do you do?
So this is where I'm hoping, and Jennifer Rubin of The Post had a good piece on this. This is where ultimately we're going to need really tough leadership from Joe Biden. As Lawrence Tribe has pointed out, the debt ceiling issue is an anomaly. No other country does this. The House had a rule in place that is another one of those that was eliminated by McCarthy, that basically was called the Hoyer rule, that you automatically increase the debt ceiling when you pass a budget that has an imbalance between revenues and spending. You've agreed to this budget, so you're going to increase the debt limit if you increase the debt. They've taken that away so they can use this for leverage. But what we also know is that the 14th Amendment includes a provision saying that the United States guarantees that its debts will be paid. So that is a constitutional lever that the president can use. We haven't had to do it before, but I think it's may well be the time where the president says, you know what? I took an oath to the Constitution. You did too. You cannot breach the debt ceiling because that is unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment. So I will continue to pay our debts and to provide the revenues. And what we're going to do is direct the Treasury Secretary to print a couple of $1 trillion platinum coins that will go into our coffers that will make sure for a very long period of time we don't come close to the debt ceiling. Now, that may end up in the courts, but the Constitution gives him that authority, and at minimum, it would mean a significant amount of
time. I've heard this theory before.
It's never been done because there was, you know, a belief that we would flirt with this, but they were too reasonable in the end, understanding the consequences, to actually let us go over the cliff.
The thing with the $1 trillion coins is that it's really important to keep track of them. You know, keep them in one place that's very secure. That's just my advice to the Treasury.
Don't put them in a box that might end up down at Mar-a-Lago either.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
The early 2000s was a wild time for reality TV. There seemed to be an endless supply of shows that delivered entertainment for us, but trauma for children. I'm Misha Brown, the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Each week on The Big Flop, comedians join me to chronicle the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? We recently looked behind the scenes of what was really going on at Abby Lee Miller's dance studio. Abby's biggest misstep wasn't screaming nonsensical catchphrases or throwing chairs on television, but instead, she was choreographing financial fraud in plain sight. Join me to break down all the wild details of Abby Lee Miller's story. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fu, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the new Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.